I'm Chris Boyd. Up next on Think, why so many Americans who should be able to vote can't. We'll spend this hour with Gilda Daniels, the former civil rights deputy chief at the U.S. Department of Justice. She says contemporary disenfranchisement tactics are remarkably effective at keeping Americans of color from voting, even without violent intimidation. We'll talk about voter purges, ID laws, and registration hurdles, and about why Daniels is pushing for a right to vote amendment to the Constitution. Our conversation starts after a short break. Voting is not a perk. It's not a privilege. It's a right. And although our Constitution contains more amendments that address voting than any other fundamental right, the text drafted by the framers did not explicitly grant individuals the right to vote. From KERA in Dallas, this is Think. I'm Chris Boyd. There's been a kind of whack-a-mole quality to the effort to keep states from drawing restrictive lines around voting rights. Strike down one law for making it too hard for voters to obtain the necessary ID. Another pops up across the country, say, kicking people off voter registration for failing to vote in midterm elections. So how can we protect all Americans from efforts to keep them from making their voices heard? Gilda R. Daniels is Associate Professor at the University of Baltimore School of Law and Litigation Director for Advancement Project's National Office. She is former Deputy Chief of the Civil Rights Division at the U.S. Department of Justice, and her book is called Uncounted, The Crisis of Voter Suppression in America. Gilda, welcome to Think.
Thank you so much, Chris.
And before we get started, we do want to welcome new Think listeners tuning in for the first time at WWNO in New Orleans. We are happy to have you with us. All right, Gilda, you open the book with a memory of your grandfather waking you up soon after daylight when you'd spent the night at his house. He would tell you you were sleeping at a dangerous time. What did he mean by that? And what does that have to do with your vigilance against voter suppression?
Well, thank you. It's a wonderful memory of staying overnight at my grandparents' home. And he would always wake us by saying, you're sleeping at a dangerous time. And certainly as a youngster, I had absolutely no idea what he was talking about because I'm like, I just had a good night's sleep. Mm-hmm. It's not that late. It's very early. What are you talking about? And so it was certainly years later where I reflected on those moments and could see how I could connect it to our current state of voting rights and our current state of democracy in these United States of America. Primarily what he meant by sleeping at a dangerous time was that you are sleeping while there's work to be done. There are things that you should be doing to advance yourself, to advance your mind, to advance, to advance a cause. And certainly I use that as a sort of metaphor, certainly as a metaphor in the book, to illustrate that while we have been sleeping through this democracy, there have been efforts that have been very effective to take the rights to vote from groups of voters. And that we've essentially been sleeping through this process, that these things have been happening and we've been looking at them in isolation. But when we look at them as a whole, when we look at them as an aggregate, we can see how these certainly disenfranchising methods have been taking away the right to vote while we are essentially sleeping with our eyes open.
At the beginning of Reconstruction, there was a surge of Black voting in the South, Black men at least. They were quickly elected to the House of Representatives. Southern whites realized they were outnumbered by the people they had kept enslaved. What did segregationists do, even soon after the passage of the 15th Amendment, to turn back the clock on Black enfranchisement?
So there was, so certainly after the passage of the Civil War amendments, the 13th Amendment that ended slavery, the 14th Amendment, which provided equal protection, and then the 15th Amendment that gave the right to vote to Black men, you did see African-American men utilize the franchise, right? They went and registered to vote and were elected to offices on the local, state, and federal levels. I often use the example of in the state of Mississippi, two African-Americans were elected to the United States Senate. We have not had two African Americans from the South since the 1890s
Wow.
elected to the United States Senate. We only currently have three African Americans in the United States Senate. So from 1890 to 2020, you haven't gotten made that much of an advance, certainly on that front. But that's an example of the power of the right to vote, and certainly how it was used during that time period when primarily only white men who owned property or white men were able to vote, as well as African American men with the passage of the 15th Amendment that banned discrimination based on the right to vote. But as you stated, shortly after, and I mean less than 20 years after the passage of the 15th Amendment, segregationists began to roll back those advances. The federal government removed federal protection. The Union soldiers who were in the South to protect African Americans as they cast ballots, as they went about their lives in the South, were removed. And once those protections were removed and the states were required to adopt the Civil War amendments, they used the opportunity to have constitutional conventions, those state constitutional conventions, to create disenfranchising devices that were very effective. And those devices were things such as a poll tax, a grandfather clause, literacy tests, felon disenfranchisement, and other measures that were used. But certainly within those state constitutions, they adopted those measures. And again, in less than 20 years, and with the protections, the protective measures that Congress had passed to remedy those dark days and inequities of slavery through the Civil War amendments and other means, were whittled away and certainly rendered impotent to stop the flood of state laws that prevented formerly enslaved persons from exercising the franchise. And as an example, Chris, in Alabama in 1890, there were 140,000 Black men who were registered to vote. Mm-hmm. But in 1906, only 46 Black persons were registered to vote in the state.
Wow.
And that's due to poll taxes, literacy tests, and other measures that were put in place in the early 1900s with the intent of removing those newly enfranchised persons from the voter rolls. They're removing Black people from the voter rolls.
Yeah, and white supremacists who did this were, I mean, clever is certainly the wrong word, but they didn't put race anywhere in these measures. So theoretically, they could have applied to anybody. What tells you that Black voters were the specific target of all these measures?
Well, it is documented that was the intent. For example, in South Carolina Senator Pitchfork, great name, right? Ben Tillman. In 1900, this is at these constitutional conventions, this is in the legislative history, right? So in the legislative history, right, Pitchfork's Ben Tillman says, quote, "We have done our level best. We have scratched our heads to find out how we could eliminate the last one of them. We stuffed ballot boxes. We shot them. We are not ashamed of it," unquote. So it was clear that certainly in places like Mississippi, when they were adopting felon disenfranchisement laws, they said, well, what crimes? Felon disenfranchisement is a mechanism that is used for persons who have been convicted of a felony, and it's only certain felonies. And the state can designate which felonies would disenfranchise of an eligible citizen. Hmm. So in Mississippi, during this constitutional convention in early 1900s, those legislators said, what crimes do Black men commit more so than white men? And they designated those crimes as crimes that where you would lose your right to vote. For example, timber theft, stealing timber, and wife beating were disenfranchising crimes. However, murder and rape were not disenfranchising crimes in the state of Mississippi in the 1900s, early 1900s. So they were explicit, certainly in their intentions. And as with the Alabama example, they were very effective because that was certainly the result across the South.
You mentioned poll taxes earlier, which don't exist anymore, but you compare voter ID laws to the poll tax, right? It costs money to get a driver's license or a state ID in most places. Is it possible to estimate the number of people who want to vote but can't because they cannot get the required ID?
Well, it's so glad you asked that question, and that we're in the state of Texas, because certainly when Texas adopted its restrictive voter ID law in 2013, after the passage of Shelby County versus Holder, there were at least three federal district courts that found that that the voter ID law was intentionally discriminatory, and courts found that there were more than 600,000 Black and Brown eligible voters who did not have those four or five documents, four or five voter ID documents that were required. So we know, so there's certainly instances where we know that particularly when you get to restrictive voter ID, where only government issued ID, like driver's license, military ID, passport, are the only acceptable forms of voter ID, that there are people and large swaths of people who do not have those types of ID, elderly people, people of color, et cetera. For example, in 2006, when Georgia passed its voter ID law, when they passed the law that said driver's license, government issued ID, military ID, passport were the acceptable forms of identification, it knew that 25% of Black voters in Georgia did not have a car. So if you know 25% of the people who should be who are eligible to vote don't have a car, why would you make a driver's license the acceptable form of identification, right? Whereas in other places, there's a list of acceptable forms of identification, because if we're trying to prove identity, you can do that a number of ways. Right, with in some states you can bring in a piece of mail with your name and address on it, like an electric bill, a gas bill. Some places, if they require a photo ID, you can use your Costco card or your Sam's card because it has an ID on it, or a credit card with an ID on it, something with your name and ID. So there are a number of ways that you can prove someone's ID. It's when states require these very small number of forms of identification, and that those forms of identification are government issued, that you can actually determine how many people are being locked out of the balloting process.
And even if people are going to get that, a driver's license or a state-issued ID, they always have to present a birth certificate. You remind us in the book there are people who don't have a copy of that and therefore have to, like, figure out how to order one. Or in the case of your 100-year-old grandmother, were never issued one in the first place.
Never issued one in the first place. Yes, and I actually used my grandmother as a frame for the book, and certainly looking at her 99 years, she passed away last year.
I'm sorry.
And thank you. And she was beloved. But certainly she did not have a birth certificate. She was a midwife birthed her, and that it was certainly the plight of many elderly people, and particularly elderly Black people. I use the story of Ms. Betty Jones in the book, and just kind of chronicle her effort to get to obtain the piece of identification that was required in Wisconsin at the time. And she went through Herculean efforts in order to get the documentation. And she talks about how, if she wouldn't have had a daughter who could help her with the process, how difficult that it would have been.
My guest is Gilda R. Daniels. She's Associate Professor at the University of Baltimore School of Law and Litigation Director for the Advancement Project's National Office. She was Deputy Chief in the U.S. Department of Justice Civil Rights Division, and she's written a book called Uncounted: The Crisis of Voter Suppression in America.
Thank you.
Boyd. My guest this hour is Gilda R. Daniels. She's litigation director for the Advancement Project's National Office and associate professor at the University of Baltimore School of Law. Previously, she was deputy chief in the U.S. Department of Justice Civil Rights Division, and her new book is called Uncounted, The Crisis of Voter Suppression in America. All right, Gilda, states, and I think there have been 34 that have at least proposed voter ID laws, have talked a lot about the concern over voter fraud. What evidence do we have that voter fraud has been happening in this country to a greater extent than it was before, you know, 10 years ago, 20 years ago, when these laws started to emerge?
None.
It's that simple?
There's absolutely no... evidence of voter fraud, and that voter ID actually answers the question of voter fraud, right? So it's certainly been described as a solution in search of a problem. For example, voter fraud has not increased over the last 10 or 20 years, so what, since 2006 or so, when we first saw these voter ID laws, last 14 years or so, voter fraud has not increased. There are measures in place to find voter fraud when it does occur. So make a short answer even longer. There is no, and for many of these voter ID laws, It was only anecdotal. Even in the Crawford versus Marion case, which is a United States Supreme Court case on voter ID, and it was in the state of Indiana, they did not have any instances of voter fraud. But their legislature essentially said, well, we need voter ID to prevent voter fraud, but they did not present any instances of voter fraud.
How often might voter ID laws tip the balance in close elections away from the candidate preferred by people of color?
Well, I think it's important to look at, and I know we'll probably get into this later, but I think it's not just voter ID, and certainly one of the reasons I wrote the book is because I thought people were looking at these issues singularly when I think we need to look at them as a group. You know, if you think about voter ID, the restrictive voter ID law that was in Texas that courts said were intentionally discriminatory, you're talking about more than 600,000 people. But you think about, and also think about the felon disenfranchisement law in Florida, you're talking about 1.3 million people. Just talking about those two different disenfranchising devices, we're talking about 2 million people. That's just two states. So if we think about the breadth of disenfranchising devices and the effect of them, yes, absolutely, they can impact elections.
So there's also the question, you know, we have some people have concerns, some people do, about, you know, voter fraud on an individual basis. There's also this thing, you know, deception. Can you talk about the Democrats' Vote on Wednesday campaigns that you've heard about?
Voter deception is certainly something that I think we need to pay more attention to, particularly in this age of misinformation, right? So there are forces that regularly come out. There's something that's often reported is, you may see now, you would see it on Facebook, or it used to be flyers placed in primarily Black and brown neighborhoods that would say Republicans vote on Tuesday, Democrats vote on Wednesday. I think one of the newer ways, certainly in using social media, I give examples in the book, certainly that occurred that where the internet was used. Certainly there was a mayor in Georgia who said, remember the voting days, Republicans vote on Tuesday and Democrats vote on Wednesday, right? And this is, he placed this on his personal Facebook account. This is an elected official, right? And at Michigan State University, students found flyers that said that they could vote by posting Hillary on Facebook and Twitter and hashtagging it presidential election, right? And so that's very deceptive, right? And so, but if you know, and so, voter deception is certainly the ways in which persons dissuade people from voting by providing them with misinformation. And so you can imagine how many students actually tweeted out hashtag Hillary, hashtag presidential election, thinking that they'd actually cast a ballot, not knowing that we're not that advanced yet. Right. And so there certainly, you know, these are statements, and there will be, you know, many more certainly during this election season, where that's why it's so important that we all know how we can vote, when we need to vote, and where we need to vote during this season.
And there's no federal law against voter deception?
No, there's a federal law against voter intimidation. And that is only, the federal government can bring a case, a voter intimidation case, under the Voting Rights Act. And it would, in a voter intimidation case, you know, and so you'd have to look at your individual state laws to see if individuals can bring an voter intimidation case. And there are also state laws. There are some states that have good laws on voter deception, but there is no federal law against deception.
Okay, I want to go back for a minute. Shelby v. Holder has come up a couple of times. This is when the Supreme Court struck down certain provisions of the Voting Rights Act in 2013. Before Shelby, the Voting Rights Act created preemptive challenges to legislation that limited voting rights, and now that protection is reactive. Can you explain what that is and why it's a big deal?
Okay, prior to the 2013 Shelby County Supreme Court opinion, the Voting Rights Act had two primary provisions. It had Section 2, which was a national prohibition against discrimination in voting, and it had Section 5, which required some jurisdictions, some states and other jurisdictions, to submit all of their voting changes to either the Attorney General for the United States or the D.C. District Court prior to their implementation. So before they could move a polling place across the street, they had to get approved by the Department of Justice. Right? Before they could say, here are the redistricting lines for this congressional redistricting, they had to be approved by the Attorney General. And, you know, while I was a deputy chief in the Civil Rights Division voting section, that was a very important process. The section received tens of thousands of changes every year, and even more during a redistricting year. And so those were very important. And it provided notice to minority communities. And the Attorney General was reviewing those changes to determine whether or not they were retrogressive, meaning that they put Black voters in a worse position. And one very important point is that the Attorney General did that in a 60-day period. So the Attorney General had 60 days to review and pre-clear or object to a change. And if it did not, then the change was deemed passed. Mm-hmm. Without Section 5, now jurisdictions are making these changes, closing polling places, purging voters, enacting new voter ID laws and other laws that affect voting without any federal oversight. And while we're finding, while we still have Section 2, that we're having to find out about them after the fact, after they've been implemented, as opposed to before. And, you know, while Section 2 is a very powerful tool, it is very costly. The average cost of a Section 2 lawsuit is more than $1 million. And those cases take more than a year, usually a year and a half to 2 years. So compare that to the 60 days under Section 5 as compared to the year and a half to 2 years under what we have that remains of the Voting Rights Act.
So at this point, it's like having to ask forgiveness after the fact. If anyone even challenges it, then ask permission beforehand.
Yes, okay. There's right. There's no requirement to ask for permission beforehand any longer.
All right, I want to go to the phones. First up is John calling from Parker County, Parker, Colorado. Excuse me. Hi, John.
Hi there. How are y'all?
Very well. How are you?
Marvelous, darling. Simply marvelous. Hey, I've been enjoying the program, but I would like to bring up a couple of points. First off, it sounds like you keep equating having a driver's license with owning a car, and let's face it, those are separate and distinct things. I can own a car without a license, and I can have a license without owning a car. I mean, I've had a driver's, well, I had a learner's permit at 15, had a driver's license at 16, and for most people, I think having a driver's license is, you know, the process of obtaining a driver's license is pretty simple and straightforward.
Well, I appreciate your call, John. Do you want to respond to that, Gilda?
Right. So when we were talking, I used the example of the percentage of persons who did not have driver's license in the state of Georgia. If you think about it in regards to voter ID, most people have a driver's license, but not a passport and not a military ID. So if you have persons who don't have need for a driver's license, then that's, you know, a segment of people who would also not have that form of identification. So the, you know, driver's license, passports, military ID, I think when you restrict it to those few forms of identification, then that just makes it harder for people to register. And I'm sorry, that makes it harder for people to participate in the process.
Let's go next on the phone to Lee in Real County, Texas. Hi, Lee.
Hello.
Hi, go right ahead, please.
My question to your guest is, do you distinguish between people that are American citizens, either by naturalization or birth, and people that are not?
There are rules of eligibility that distinguishes persons who are eligible to vote and persons who are American citizens or born as American citizens or naturalized citizens have the ability to vote, as well as people who live in Puerto Rico and migrate to the United States, which we saw certainly after the hurricane, I think last year or 2 years ago, large numbers of people migrating from Puerto Rico have the right to vote whether they are. So certainly persons who are born in the United States, as well as those who are naturalized citizens, are eligible to vote. So whatever eligibility, you know, age, residency, those are all, citizenship are things. So there's no, I guess I'm not distinguishing between persons who are born in the United States and then persons who are naturalized. It's, if you're eligible to vote, then we're making, whether or not the states and other locales are making it harder for you to do so.
I think that is another concern for people, that somehow people who are not in the country legally are trying to vote in large numbers. What do you know about that, Gilda?
Well, I know that there's not, with the voter fraud issue, that there have been a number of reports and studies, and non-citizen voting is at the same level as other voter fraud issues. People imagine that it's rampant. It is not.
This is Think. I'm Chris Boyd. I don't want to talk about voter roll purges, which have been an area of concern in recent years, especially when they knock people off the voter rolls who are still qualified to vote, still living in the same place. What reasons do counties and states give for culling those registration lists? Why would that be a priority?
Well, election officials certainly have list maintenance procedures where they certainly have to maintain an accurate list. And one of the ways that they do that is they remove persons, people who have moved, and they have moved out of the state or moved out of the jurisdiction, or are removed, and folk who have died are also removed. It's a process that the jurisdictions use to remove that's problematic. Often it is filled with inaccuracies. We certainly saw that certainly we go all the way back to 2000, where folk in Florida were removed because they said that they had committed felonies, and many of them had not. They didn't do 100% matches, meaning you may have been Thomas Johnson, but it was the person you removed was Thomas M. Johnson, right? So not having 100% matches. So there, so it can be problematic. Another reason that people are removed and that the United States Supreme Court recently said was allowed was removing persons for not voting. So for example, in the case Husted versus A. Philip Randolph Institute, which was out of Ohio, the United States Supreme Court said that you could remove persons for not voting in two consecutive federal elections. So if you missed a midterm election and a presidential election, you could be removed and then would need to re-register. In some places, they put you on an inactive list after you miss the first federal election. And then if you don't show up for the second federal election, you are removed. So if you're, you know, if you have listeners who have not voted in a federal election, they need to, you know, verify that they're still on the voter rolls and to make sure that they can cast a ballot or need to re-register. And in some places, when you go to the polls, if you're on the inactive list, then they reinstate you. In other places, you may have to register.
I'm not aware of any requirement to vote in, you know, at least every other federal election. Is that just implied by a law like that?
Well, here's the problem. So there is a law, the National Voter Registration Act, or otherwise referred to as the Motor Voter Law, actually stated that you could not remove persons for not voting. And certainly, you know, one of the things that I talk about in the book is that, you know, you actually have a right not to vote, right? You can exercise it or not. One of the quotes in the book is a military veteran who said, "I don't lose my right to own a gun if I don't buy a gun. Why do I lose my right to vote if I don't vote?"
My guest is Gilda R. Daniels. We're talking about her new book, Uncounted, The Crisis of Voter Suppression in America. Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is Gilda R. Daniels, associate professor at the University of Baltimore School of Law, former deputy chief in the U.S. Department of Justice Civil Rights Division, and author of Uncounted, The Crisis of Voter Suppression in America. So before the break, Gilda, you mentioned the National Voter Registration Act passed in 1993. Among the things it set out to do was allow people to register when they are registering for a driver's license, that sort of thing. Why did a number of states try to push back against that?
Well, I guess that's a complicated question, but the National Voter Registration Act, certainly the pushback had to do, it increased the number of registered voters, and it provided more opportunities for people to register and vote, because if you receive federal funds at your social service agencies or Veterans Administration, then you were required to designate those as voter registration outlets. And the states also designated other outlets as well, like libraries and other places. So certainly there's pushback because, you know, states initially, when the law was passed, states originally contested it as an unfunded mandate, saying that, you know, it would require more money to do these registrations. But we found certainly that registration opportunities at the Department of Motor Vehicles has certainly increased the number of persons who are registered and who can actually vote, which is one of the issues that we had certainly during the lockdowns in various states, is that motor vehicle associations were closed. And so persons who would normally get a driver's license and register were not able to do so. So we're now, you know, people have to get registered in most places 30 days before the election in order to cast a ballot in the upcoming election.
All right, let's go next on the phone to Calvin in Rockwall, Texas. Hi, Calvin.
Yes, my question is that according to the Constitution, does it say that I should purchase my right to vote, or does it say I have the right to vote? And shouldn't that burden fall on the state as opposed to on the citizen himself? And when you're born, you get a birth certificate, so the state knows who you are. So I would say, conversely, unless you move from that state, they already know who you are already, because it's defined within the birth certificate and you pay the cost to get a copy of the birth certificate. So that's my question.
Thanks for calling. So, yeah, should that burden fall on citizens or on the state to sort of prove who's eligible to vote?
Well, it's a very interesting question, and that's something that people are trying to answer now. There's actually a right to vote amendment saying that you have the constitutional right to vote. In the Bush v. Gore case of 2000, the Supreme Court told us essentially that we don't have the right to elect or we don't have the right to vote, right? That it's not an explicit right in the United States Constitution. So there's a lot of debate about whether or not we actually need a right to vote amendment, something that explicitly says you have the right to vote, much like you get a Social Security card when you're born, you request that you get a Social Security card. Why not when you turn 18, you get a voter registration. You are registered to vote, and that registration stays with you throughout your life, right? As opposed to the process that we currently have, where every state has a different way of determining, certainly within the bounds of the Constitution, right? That they don't deny a person, they cannot deny a person's right to vote based on race, ethnicity, age, poll tax, those kinds of things. But certainly some of these devices tend to do those things. But you know, do we need a right to vote amendment? It's certainly something that folk are debating. There's a lot of information out there on that. We certainly need something that can secure the right to vote. I agree that we need to make it easier.
What do you think a right to vote amendment to the Constitution would do for voting rights that the 15th and 19th Amendments failed to do?
Well, Chris, we found that the 15th and 19th Amendments were not enough, right? With the 15th Amendment and giving the right to vote to Black men, we saw that in the early 1900s, you had these constitutional conventions that essentially stripped the right to vote. In 1920, when the 19th Amendment was ratified and gave women the right to vote, it essentially gave white women the right to vote. Mm-hmm. Persons like my grandmother, who lived in Louisiana and was African American, did not vote or could not vote until the 1960s. But she should have been allowed to vote in the 1940s. But because she was a Black woman and lived in the South, she couldn't vote until after the passage of the Voting Rights Act. And now we certainly see that there are devices in place that still preclude persons of color, in particular, from casting a ballot. So there's certainly more to it's certainly certainly more is needed. Restoring what was lost in Shelby County versus Holder, or having an amendment on the right to vote that explicitly gives the right to vote are all things that are being considered, and certainly would help in making it easier for people to access the right.
All right, back to the phones. Kathy is on the line in Helotes. Hi, Kathy.
Hello, how are you?
Very well, thanks.
Good. I have a question. If we don't force people to show some form of valid ID, what would prevent me from, having a wedding for my granddaughter and inviting a couple of hundred people, many from out of country, to come in, and then it's on voting day, say, okay, as part of the proceedings, we're going to all go vote right now.
Thanks for calling.
Well, I think it's important. I mean, there are various ways to identify if a person is who they say they are, right? And what I talk about in the book and things that I challenge are when it's restrictive, when you have limited the ways in which a person can demonstrate their identity, right, to very restrictive means, then you essentially are determining who can cast a ballot as opposed to having all eligible persons cast a ballot. I think in the caller's example, having other means such as the gas bill, electric bill, something with some other type of photogenic identification, like a student ID from a state university or from a university. Those are all things that could prove identity that should be utilized.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Can you talk about the ways that you think a national holiday for voting might help broaden voter access and participation?
Yes, and I also want to go back to say signature. There are a number of states that only ask for your signature, and so they do the signature matching also in regards to voter ID. Mm-hmm. Now, back to whether or not there needs to be a holiday for voting. There are some states, like the state of Virginia, which has now made Election Day a holiday. Again, that's a measure that would make it easier for people to cast a ballot to get to the polls. But we also have to look beyond the actual election day. We can think about early voting. And I know absentee voting is very difficult in Texas, but certainly if you're eligible to vote absentee, doing that. But again, utilizing having ways in which people can vote safely and securely and that their vote can be counted is, I think, what we should all be working towards.
So let's talk about this year. There are lots of concerns. It's, you know, the pandemic is happening. No one a year ago could have predicted this. But how do you think things are going to play out? And do you see signs for optimism anywhere in the country that states are actually making a concerted effort to ensure people who are eligible to vote are, in fact, able to do so?
Well, I think there are signs that states are finally thinking ahead or trying to think ahead and plan for voting in the midst of a pandemic, right? Many of these are things that, you know, would be helpful to have in place even if we weren't in the middle of this crisis. Certainly the CDC has guidelines on what it prescribes in regards to voting in a pandemic, things such as having 30 days of early voting. We know that in the state of Texas, Governor Greg Abbott actually just extended early voting an additional 7 days. That is being challenged, but extending early voting would help because it allows people more opportunity to actually get to the polls. And so you don't have these 5 hour, 6 hour, 10 hour lines that we certainly saw it during some of the presidential preference primaries. So I think there is optimism in that, states are recognizing that we have to do the work now to make sure that the right to vote is not compromised.
This is Think. I'm Chris Boyd. All right, back to the phones. We'll speak now with Greg in Temple, Texas. Hi, Greg.
Hi. Given that the right to vote is at the heart of our democracy, how is it that we don't have more severe penalties for voter suppression and more prosecutions?
Thanks for calling.
That's a great question. that's certainly been my work over the last 20 years. Looking at certainly enforcing voting rights and ensuring that all persons have the opportunity to register and to cast a ballot, and that they're not discriminated against. How is it that we don't have stronger laws on voter suppression? I just don't think we don't have the political will to do it. That it's going to take. The Voting Rights Act was certainly extraordinary, and the courts have considered extraordinary. Ronald Reagan called it a crown jewel. Lyndon Baines Johnson that it was monumental, and it certainly provided protections against suppressive measures. And now that it's been gutted, we certainly need more.
What effect do you think it will have that the sitting president of the United States has expressed concern that somehow the results of the upcoming election will be tainted, inaccurate, fraudulent?
Well, I think it's important to remember that we know how to run elections. We're supposed to be a democracy, right? That's what we That's what we're supposed to. We're supposed to know how to do, how to conduct elections better than anyone else in the world. We do it regularly. I don't think that people should have concerns about the legitimacy of the election. I will caution folk to have some patience, because if we do have more absentee ballots or mail ballots, that the process for counting those will take longer than just, you know, going into a polling place and pushing a button. So you may not know who the president is on November 3rd or even on November 5th, but that doesn't mean that somehow the system has broken down. That means that the system is working, that we are actually counting every vote. So if every vote counts, we need to count every vote. And again, we're supposed to be the leaders of democracy. We know how to hold elections. We know how to count votes. I don't think that people should be concerned.
Although this whole hour has been about, you know, things that seem to interfere with people's right and ability to cast ballots that get counted.
Yes, it has been. And so I think it's important that we recognize when that right to vote is being compromised. And certainly we have seen historically, as well as contemporaneously, that certainly in the United States, that voting has been reserved for only certain people. Right. And that certainly we know initially with the founding fathers, the right to vote was only given to white men who owned property, and then black men, and then women. But then there were also laws that took those rights away. And we're seeing certainly those kinds of cycles that are occurring today when we're making it harder for people to access the franchise instead of making it easier.
Gilda R. Daniels is Associate Professor at the University of Baltimore School of Law and Litigation Director for the Advancement Project's National Office. She's former Deputy Chief of the Civil Rights Division of the U.S. Department of Justice and author of Uncounted, The Crisis of Voter Suppression in America. Gilda, thanks so much for spending this time with us.
Thank you, Chris.
You can like our page on Facebook. We're on Twitter at KERA Think. Subscribe to our podcast, free wherever you get podcasts, by searching for KERA Think. You can also listen anytime on our website, think.kera.org. Again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening. Have a great day.